Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегеран.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for the explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 11th of April, these are our main stories. A property developer in Vietnam is sentenced to death for defrauding a bank of billions of dollars in one of the biggest corruption cases ever. President Zelensky makes a plea for more air defences after a third of Russia's strikes on energy infrastructure overnight are not intercepted. And South Korea's Prime Minister Han Duck-soo offers his resignation. Also in this podcast, more security on the New York subway after incidents of gun violence.
Rattling off statistics, saying things are getting better, doesn't make you feel better. Especially when you've just heard about someone being slashed in the throat or thrown onto a subway's tracks.
First, the Vietnamese property tycoon Trong My Lan has been sentenced to death as part of one of the world's biggest ever fraud cases involving billions of dollars. Along with more than 80 others, she was arrested as part of a crackdown on corruption. She denied the charges and blamed other employees, claiming to have little knowledge of the banking sector. But the court found she knowingly stole funds using fake loan applications and had bribed officials. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head is in Bangkok and told me how rare a death sentence for a woman is.
This is unusual. We found one other case of a woman, a state official, being sentenced to death for a white-collar crime like this. But this is such a sensational case, and the authorities have been very free with the details. They've encouraged the Vietnamese media to report every aspect of it. I think wanting to make an example of Trong My Lan to show the public that they are serious about curbing corruption, which is a known problem. I mean, it's part of life in Vietnam. It's everywhere. But also, I think, hoping to direct public anger and frustration over that very much towards her. She's sort of been demonised and held up as this, you know, this figure. And if you look at some of the feedback that we see on BBC websites from Vietnamese readers, they all approve of this death penalty. They think she should get it. But of course, there's a very big question that hangs over this case, which is that she was able to take control. She actually formed this bank with the approval of the state authority. She was very involved in it. She had hidden, but could easily have been found, ownership, control of the bank, 90% of the bank she controlled. And for 11 years, she used that to appoint her own officials, according to prosecutors, and direct these, I mean, the sums are staggering, $44 billion of loans to her own companies. That went on for 11 years. And I think were Vietnam a rather freer place in terms of public discussion, many people would be asking how many other people are implicated apart from those on trial today. How was a government in so much in control unable to spot this fraud before now?
There's a lot of talk online about the idea that the death penalty is really being used here as a mechanism to try to get some of the money back. Do you buy that?
Well, it's, you know, part of the Vietnamese judicial system or the way that it operates. And remember, it's not a free one. This was in many ways a completely foregone conclusion, this verdict. And part of it is encouraging those who are accused to give back funds. We've seen all the other defendants who have been pleading for leniency, all the others admitted their guilt, offering to give back as much money as they could find. So it is part of the system that if you give back money, you can get a lower sentence. I think they'll be hoping she does that. Just remember what the size of the hole in the public finances from this. According to the state, $27 billion of the loans she took out are non-recoverable. At least they can't recover them. I think they're hoping that she digs around and comes up with more assets. Remember, she's a hugely wealthy property owner that will help them cover a hole which is certainly going to damage the public finances as they try to rescue this bank.
Jonathan Head in Bangkok, and 85 others involved in the corruption have received lesser sentences, including four who were given life in prison. A Russian bombardment may have completely destroyed a key Ukrainian power plant outside Kyiv, as power facilities were targeted across five regions in the early hours of this morning. According to government data, nearly a third of the Russian drones and missiles were not shot down. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Ukraine.
Russia is deliberately and systematically targeting Ukraine's energy system, and this was another massive attack. In the early hours of morning, more than 80 missiles and drones targeted sites right across the country, and almost a third made it through Ukraine's air defences. In the northeast, Kharkiv's power plant suffered major damage in late March, and the region has now been hard hit again. The mayor there describes the situation as very difficult, announcing even more blackouts for households and businesses. The metro has stopped running to save power. It's operating now only as a shelter from incoming missiles. President Zelensky has condemned what he called a heinous attack, and he's called once again for more air defence systems from Western allies. The Russian strikes are now far more accurate and more devastating, and Ukraine is struggling to cope. In the west of the country, at least two more thermal power plants suffered significant damage overnight, placing even more strain on electricity supply nationwide. The DTEC power company was already down to 20% capacity after repeated attacks. The situation now is even worse.
In Russian-occupied Ukraine, the stability of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest, is in question after strikes on Sunday for which both sides have refused to take the blame. The Board of Governors at the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, is due to hold an emergency meeting. Its Director General is Rafael Mariano Grossi.
Any attack aiming a nuclear power plant is unacceptable, is irresponsible, is reckless. One of the reactors is operating at a very, very low regime, low level, to produce some steam. But still, we have tons of nuclear material around, within the reactors, outside the reactors, at spent fuel storage facilities. So I would not go along with this notion that, you know, it's not so serious, let's not be worried. This is extremely worrying.
South Korea's Prime Minister Han Duck-soo has offered his resignation after his right-wing party, the People Power Party, suffered a crushing defeat in parliamentary elections. This result allows their rivals, the Democratic Party, to fast-track bills and block the agenda of the Conservative president. Jean McKenzie is in Seoul.
This is a landslide victory for the opposition parties here in South Korea. Yes, they won a similar number of seats in the last general election back in 2020, but the circumstances were very different. There was a hugely popular liberal president in office at the time. And so this defeat for the ruling party is being seen as a vote of no confidence in the current president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who's been in office for 2 years. It does weaken his authority, even though it might seem on paper that not much has changed when you look at the seats. When it comes to the day-to-day politics, it means that the president is going to struggle to pass votes and push forward with his agenda, because the opposition parties are going to be able to team up to fast-track the laws they like and block the laws they don't. And so it is going to be more difficult for the government to tackle some of the urgent issues that South Korea faces, from rising food prices, a slowing economy, a rapidly ageing society. When it comes to foreign policy, the parliament has less say, and so we might see the president focus more on this, as he has done over the past 2 years. He has made some pretty radical changes to foreign policy in his time. He has taken a tough stance on North Korea. He's built up his relationship with the United States and Japan in order to counter North Korea and China. But crucially, he had the authority to do so because he had just won a presidential election. Now he has, in effect, lost an election. That is going to weaken his leadership. It will give him less clout abroad, and it will make it more difficult for him to push ahead with foreign policy that doesn't have popular support here in South Korea.
Jean McKenzie in Seoul. Several viral and frightening incidents of gun violence and other attacks on the New York subway system have raised questions about commuter safety on one of the busiest transport systems in the world. About 3 million people ride the subway each day. And while the data shows the chance of falling victim to a violent crime is slim, the public is wary. In response, the authorities have stepped up security measures. Our correspondent in New York is Neda Torfik.
The moment of sheer panic as gunshots are fired on a New York City subway carriage and desperate riders are finally able to flee the confined car.
Let me out! Let me out! Let me out!
This was just one of a series of random frightening incidents that have gone viral in recent months. In this video, musician Ian Forrest was playing in Herald Square in February when he was attacked for the second time in less than a year.
Kind of in the middle of the song, I just felt all of a sudden abruptly this acute pain on the back of my head, and I saw my bottle rolling around on the ground. Did I realize, oh my God, someone just, you know, smacked the back of my head with my metal water bottle. I talked to so many other musicians who came up to me afterwards saying, I've experienced something similar. I've been harassed, I've been attacked, I've been robbed.
The subway is the lifeblood of New York, and with budgets strained, officials are eager to calm fears to get riders to return post-pandemic. New York's Governor Kathy Hochul has deployed 1,000 part-time soldiers of the National Guard and police into the underground network, all while insisting that transit is safe.
Rattling off statistics, saying things are getting better, doesn't make you feel better. Especially when you've just heard about someone being slashed in the throat or thrown onto a subway's tracks.
The increased presence of National Guard and police officers at the subway's entrances has been noticeable, even if they aren't at every station. Now, when you look at the data, it doesn't suggest that there's a safety epidemic on the subways. Nevertheless, when you speak to New Yorkers, they're mixed on whether or not things are really getting worse and if the National Guard is necessary.
It's a threat to have hostile, violent people that attack in unprovoked manners for no reason.
Do you feel unsafe in the subway?
No, everybody. Oh, no, I ain't ever scared.
Now, instead of attacking, we're going to grab the arm and pull. Okay?
Enrollment for self-defense classes are on the rise at this martial arts studio, Krav Maga Experts. Zahi Shamesh is the owner.
Everybody knows someone that's been attacked or harassed. Or just, it's on the news a lot. So I think it's just in people's faces a lot more.
Cool. Like this on one side.
Zahi and others here, such as student Lucy Baker, believe that putting a stop to subway crime also involves investing in poverty reduction and mental health. In fact, an official survey by the Metropolitan Transit Authority found commuters were far more concerned about people behaving erratically than a more visible police presence.
There's definitely, like, a mental health crisis, like, drug problems in the city. We've put, like, so much money into, like, the police force, but, like, what are we putting to, like, prevent these people from getting onto the streets and stuff?
Ian doesn't plan on performing in the subway for the time being. Instead, the medical student has taken his music above ground at Mount Sinai Hospital, where he can safely share his talent.
It was, you know, my outlet, my creative outlet to perform in the subway. So to have that all, you know, taken away in an instant, it's absolutely heart-wrenching.
Our correspondent Neda Torfik reporting from New York. Still to come on this podcast, the death has been announced in Japan of the first foreign-born sumo grand champion and new excavations in Pompeii.
We're looking into a three-sided room. Its floor is covered with these black mosaic. So you can imagine that when it's really clean, the colours would have been amazing.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the country is continuing its war in Gaza, but also preparing for scenarios in other areas. His comments came amid concern that Iran is said to be planning an imminent attack in retaliation for the killing of senior members of the Revolutionary Guard in Syria last week. President Biden assured Israel the U.S. is ready to protect it.
They're threatening to launch a significant attack on Israel. As I told Prime Minister Netanyahu, our commitment to Israel's security against these threats from Iran and its proxies is ironclad. Let me say it again, ironclad. We're going to do all we can to protect Israel's security.
An American general is in Israel to talk about Washington's fears. One official is quoted as saying, it's a matter of when, not if. I've been speaking to our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
It's certainly the messaging from US officials in Washington that they think there is a credible threat of an Iranian strike onto Israeli soil among a range of possibilities that they think the Iranians are looking at. Remember, the starting point of this particular episode, as you mentioned, was the strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. And we had the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, saying yesterday that he regarded that as an attack on Iranian soil and that Israel would be punished for this. And then increasingly threatening rhetoric really from both sides and about how the Israelis would respond to that. And I thought it was striking that President Biden himself said that Iran is threatening a significant attack on Israel. I think a note of caution is to say that by very publicly putting it out there, I think in Washington, they are, you know, this is part of an attempt to try to get the Iranians to stand down or to sort of preemptively de-escalate whatever they might be thinking about. And certainly there was some urgent diplomacy with messages being passed from the Americans via Arab countries to the Iranians to try to lower the temperature in the region. But I do think, as far as the Americans are concerned, you know, their big fear had always been of a regional conflagration around the Gaza war. And I, you know, my sense is they think that this is as close as it has ever been in the last 6 months.
And we're getting rapidly changing language from Joe Biden about Israel this week. Only yesterday he was talking about Israel's conduct in Gaza being a mistake, and now his support for Israel is ironclad.
Well, that's an important point here, because, and I think also it plays into why the message is pretty public and quite loud from the Americans about that ironclad support, as you mentioned. Because, you know, the administration is very aware that there is a very significant rift between it and the Israelis over Israel's conduct in Gaza. They know that Israel's adversaries are aware of the strains on that relationship. And I think this is an attempt, you know, from President Biden downwards to say, OK, you know, if there are differences over Gaza, there are not differences over the Iranian threat and the threat from Iran's allies in the region. So I think, again, that's why they're trying to sort of signal and message that, as they call it, ironclad support very publicly at the moment.
Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Here on the Global News podcast, we've been talking about Arizona's decision to introduce a near total ban on abortion, the 15th US state to do so. In Poland, things are going in the opposite direction as Parliament considers liberalising the country's strict abortion laws. Currently, terminations are only allowed when the pregnancy endangers the mother's health or when it's a result of rape or incest. This proposition would give women access to abortion on demand up to 12 weeks of pregnancy, a right which Polish women haven't had for more than 30 years. From Warsaw, here's our correspondent, Adam Easton.
It's the start of the debate in Parliament. It's very significant. Poland's pro-EU Prime Minister Donald Tusk came to power pledging to offer greater access to abortion. And many, many opinion polls over the years are showing a trend that more and more people in Poland are supporting greater access to abortion in this very Roman Catholic country where it's one of the most strict laws in the EU currently. But the politicians up to this point have been reluctant to act. In fact, the previous right-wing Law and Justice government presided over heightened restrictions to the abortion law, backed by the Roman Catholic Church, and that triggered massive street protests right across the country during the height of the COVID pandemic restrictions. It's not going to be easy for the Polish parliament to actually push through a liberalization of the law, because Donald Tusk presides over a coalition government from the left, centrist, to agrarian conservatives, and even they don't agree on how far this liberalisation should go. And in fact, there are competing proposals presented by those different coalition members. On the other side of the political aisle, the opposition, right-wing opposition, Law and Justice, another small party, they oppose liberalisation. And ultimately, the country's Catholic Church-going president, Andrzej Duda, also has the power to veto any legislation that Parliament approves, and it's quite likely that he would do so.
Julian Assange might not face prosecution in the United States after an Australian request for him to be returned home. The founder of WikiLeaks published a huge trove of US military files in 2010 and 2011 and is being pursued for espionage. Joe Biden has suggested, though, it might be called off. Stella Assange, the wife of Julian Assange, has been talking to my colleague, Johnny Diamond.
I think it's a good sign. The Prime Minister of Australia said that he is optimistic. So it looks like things could be moving in the right direction. And obviously after not just 5 years in Belmarsh High Security Prison, but 14 years since he effectively lost his freedom right after publishing this trove, then lots of people around the world have been saying for years that this case should be dropped.
The comment and the suggestion that the hunt for your husband may be called off comes at an interesting time, doesn't it? Because the UK courts, who are pondering the extradition request, are waiting for an assurance from the US authorities that the death penalty wouldn't be used.
Yes, that's right. The High Court gave Julian a kind of conditional leave to appeal and asked the US for so-called assurances in relation to the death penalty and also in relation to the First Amendment protections, because they identified that he is being charged for publishing these documents which evidenced war crimes, and that the United States itself in its arguments has said that he may not be able to use the constitutional protections on press freedom because he's an Australian citizen.
The critics of your husband attack the way that he published the material. They say it jeopardized lives.
We categorically deny any claim that he did not publish responsibly. He published and took every measure of care. Under oath, the United States has had to admit that they have seen no evidence of any person coming to physical harm as a result of these publications. What we do know is that these publications revealed this physical destruction and death of tens of thousands. But I must say, this is a prosecution that is from the Trump era. It's a Trump legacy, and really Joe Biden should have dropped it from day one. His predecessor, Obama, decided not to pursue this prosecution. They said that it would set a precedent that could be used against the rest of the press because it criminalizes journalistic activity.
Stella Assange talking to Johnny Diamond. The death has been announced in Japan of the first foreign-born sumo grand champion. Ake Bono, who is 54, suffered heart failure earlier this month. Winning 11 championships, he paved the way for many other foreign-born wrestlers and broke down cultural barriers in this traditional sport, eventually becoming a Japanese citizen. After retiring in 2001, Ake Bono also enjoyed further success in pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. Here's our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Halil.
Ake Bono was a towering figure in Grand Sumo. The 11-time champion helped fuel a sumo boom in the 1990s, attracting millions of viewers. At over 2 meters tall and weighing more than 200 kilograms, he was famous for his fighting style and thrusting his opponents out of the ring. Ake Bono, born Chad Rowan in Hawaii, was Grand Sumo's first ever foreign-born yokozuna, the highest rank any wrestler can attain in the sport. In 1996, he became a Japanese citizen and took the name Taro Ake Bono. Fellow sumo champion Masaru Hanada described him as a rival, a friend, and a person full of love. The U.S. ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel, said the former champion opened the door for other foreign wrestlers to find success in sumo, adding that he was a proud Hawaiian and a bridge between the U.S. and Japan.
The excavation of a previously undiscovered part of Pompeii has revealed a sumptuous villa with floor-to-ceiling frescoes and stunning mosaic floors beneath volcanic debris. Archaeologists believe a rich, influential man who may have run for public office lived there. They also think he may have been the owner of a bakery next door where slaves were probably kept in what was virtually a prison. Our science editor Rebecca Morell is in Pompeii.
I've come to Pompeii. You can see Mount Vesuvius looming over this Roman city, which of course was buried by an eruption here 2,000 years ago. Now the biggest excavation in a generation is taking place, and it's really giving us a new glimpse at this city which has been frozen in time for so long. And there are so many extraordinary new finds here. Now I'm joined by Sophie Hay, an archaeologist at Pompeii. You're going to show me some of the amazing rooms which have been found. You're sort of looking down, aren't you? We're standing at ground level, but
we're still on top of all the Vesuvian eruption material, and at least 3-4 meters below us, we're at Roman ground level. And at the moment, we're looking into a three-sided room, which would have once looked out through a sort of colonnaded portico into a garden area. And this big room is absolutely stunning. Its floor is covered with these black mosaic with little insets of coloured marble. So you can imagine that when it's really clean, the colours would have been amazing.
going to go down a bit further into the excavation.
Yeah.
Let's head over. We're in a courtyard now, interior courtyard.
Yes, so this is a courtyard within a house, which is very common in the Roman period. They do inside and outside simultaneously. And the view, I have to say, is so dramatic. In front of us, at the far side of this courtyard, we have an opening which they haven't yet excavated, but sort of splurging out in a sort of torrent is this 3 metre high pile of lapilli, which is the little pumice stones that rained down on Pompeii for 18 hours. It's kind of surging through an open doorway. And on the top, we have the layers of the pyroclastic flow, which sealed Pompeii for good. And if you were still in the city then, you were dead.
I mean, this is basically the avalanche of gas and volcanic material, which was moved very quickly across the town. We're going to head down a bit more because we're kind of heading from the opulent, this grand residence, into a commercial area. So, Sophie, we're being quite careful about where we're treading, but here we've come into a bakery. It's here where we get a glimpse into the sort of darker side of Roman life.
Working in a bakery is not about the nice smell of freshly baked bread at all. For the slaves that work here, they're working pretty much 24 hours a day. It's not an easy life. The air would be thick with the dust of flour. Breathing would be an issue. Of course, it gets very hot, so that would be not nice. The slaves who work here have to live in a small room, and they found bars on the skylight to stop them escaping. So we've kind of described it as a prison bakery. People who are working here are held captive here until somebody lets them out. So it always sort of tugs at the heartstrings a little bit to find people and understand their story and do them justice. And I think that's our job as archaeologists, is to obviously treat them with respect, but do their story justice.
Dr. Sophie Hay with Rebecca Morell in Pompeii. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, you'll find us. We're at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nicola Brough. The producer was Terry Egan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.